Chapter 12. The United States v. Charles Wilson. Wilson's drug lawyer, Stuart Pearson, is a good-looking, virile man with enormous self-confidence. As he approached Charlie Wilson's office in early 1983, about the last thing on his mind was the war in Afghanistan. He was a specialist in white-collar crime, and he was on a mission to rescue yet another endangered politician. Such lawyers are accustomed to feeling powerful as they move through the wreckage of great men's lives. But when Pearson walked into the congressman's office, past the gorgeous receptionists, and shook hands with the charismatic Texan, he was keenly aware of the physical difference between himself and his new client. Pearson is a short man, and he actually experienced a curious shrinking sensation as he dropped several inches into the cushions of the huge hand-tooled and leather-upholstered chairs that Wilson kept in front of his desk. It was ridiculous, but it quickly seemed apparent that Wilson was trying to put him in his place. The congressman remained on his feet, strutting about the room, all 6'4" of him, talking cheerily in that booming Texas voice, as if Pearson had dropped by for nothing more than a social visit. Pearson, however, sensed danger in the congressman's aggressive state of denial, and decided he had better introduce an element of reality. When Wilson finally offered him an opening by asking, "What's the worst that can happen to me?" Pearson devastated him with his answer. "It's not just your political career you can lose, Charlie. You could go to jail over this." Pearson went on matter-of-factly to explain that the FBI agents were not stupid, and that they would assume that Wilson was deeply involved in a distribution network on the Hill. A congressman who is allegedly using cocaine has to get it from someone safe, so the natural assumption of any prosecutor is that there has to be a sophisticated network. "In a practical sense," said Pearson, "what that meant is that every employee, friend, and drinking buddy of Wilson's would be visited by federal agents. Anyone could turn on him, for real or imagined crimes." "This is not just about Liz Wickersham's testimony," he said. "There are other people in your office who could hurt you." Pearson's physical stature was suddenly enhanced as the shaken Wilson realized that his fate might well rest in this man's hands. The first thing any criminal defense attorney does upon taking a case is to impose a damage control mechanism to prevent the clients from getting into more trouble. But even before this meeting, Pearson had felt a particular urgency. He had been studying Wilson as a psychoanalyst might his patient, and he figured that the congressman's performance to date had been just about as bad as it could be. When Brian Ross of NBC had cornered him with his camera crew, Wilson had made the mistake of looking like a burglar caught in the beam of a cop's flashlight, turning on his heels and fleeing back into his hotel room. What had alarmed Pearson even more was how Wilson had compounded the disaster by subsequently inviting Ross into his room for an off-the-record talk, in some kind of crazed belief that he could charm his way out of his predicament. Pearson couldn't quite understand why, after 4 terms in Congress, and after weaving his way through so many scandals, Charlie had not simply beamed confidently at the reporter like Ronald Reagan always did, and kept moving. Ross's story might not even have made the evening news had Wilson handled himself like a pro. As far as Pearson was concerned, this client was a walking time bomb. If he was to have any chance, Wilson would have to be fenced in, and Pearson proceeded to read him the riot act. Absolutely no talking to the press. Perhaps even more important, he stressed the danger of talking to Liz Wickersham. Everything depended on her. The feds were pressuring her to testify that the congressman had been snorting cocaine. He could end up with an obstruction of justice charge for almost anything he said to her. The congressman was all ears now, and Pearson was not about to miss the opportunity to drive home just how grave the situation was. He warned Charlie that it was highly likely that justice would bug his phones. This was particularly terrifying news to Wilson, who suddenly remembered Chuck Cogan's visit to his office just a few weeks earlier. Security officials had told him how easy it would be for the KGB to listen in on everything Wilson was saying merely by casting a beam onto his window. Soon after Pearson's warning, window washers suddenly appeared outside the congressman's window. The staff informed him that furniture cleaners had arrived uninvited. The whole office was reduced to near paranoia as Wilson's intake of scotch began assuming alarming proportions. It was at this point that the depression kicked in, so badly that some of the people around Wilson began to worry that he might kill himself. Wilson says he never even considered taking such an action. But his lawyer, Stuart Pearson, fearing that he had perhaps gone too far in arousing his client's fears, began a massive effort to reassure Charlie. "I almost destroyed my liver on that case," he remembered years later. "It was hard not to drink with Charlie because I quickly developed a lot of affection for him, and in any of these investigations you have to provide comfort as well as legal advice." The lawyer remembers those drinking and therapy sessions today almost with disbelief. Once in the congressman's office, he'd watched with amazement as Wilson filled a 4-inch tumbler with ice and scotch. Over the course of an hour and a half, Wilson downed a total of 4 of these sledgehammers. At first, Pearson thought the alcohol was necessary, a tranquilizer for his unstable client. But then he began to worry that Wilson was in such a dangerous state of mind that he needed round-the-clock watching. That's when Pearson discovered the loyalty of Charlie's friends, who, in the end, saved the day. The first to impress Pearson were the Angels, who quietly took over the office, shielding Charlie from the media, doing his work for him, comforting him, and, best of all, from Pearson's point of view, keeping their mouths shut. So did all of Charlie's friends, starting with the most vulnerable of all, Liz Wickersham, who spoiled everything for the prosecutors by holding the line. Another friend with more guilty knowledge than perhaps anyone, the famous Texas author Larry King, also found himself being grilled about Charlie's habits. King had been a wild, two-fisted drinker who had spent many years getting into all sorts of trouble carousing with Charlie, particularly during the time Justice was interested in. King had almost joined Wilson as an investor in Paul Brown's plan to produce a soap opera with Liz Wickersham as its star. On the occasion of his 7th year in AA and his 7th year of being sober, King stopped to recall his answer to the authorities who wanted to know about Charlie. "I'd like to help you," he had told the investigators, "but just after the period in question I went into rehabilitation, and everything from that time frame is a blank." It had to have been grotesquely frustrating for the feds, who ran into one stone wall after another as they deposed the congressman's conveniently forgetful staff and friends. But then that summer they got lucky. The dragnet that had been thrown out to find the limousine driver who had taken Charlie and Liz and Paul Brown back from the airport after the Las Vegas weekend came up with its man. One can only imagine the excitement in the halls of the Justice Department as the investigators prepared to interrogate the driver, 20-year-old Bill Cheshire. The young man told them he remembered the congressman well and said he would be happy to give them a deposition. Now all Justice had to do to put Wilson into a concrete cell was to get Cheshire to confirm what Brown had already told them, that the Texas congressman had snorted cocaine in the back seat of the limousine. While the authorities were busy laying their traps for Wilson, the congressman was busy projecting himself publicly as a man without a care in the world. For his 50th birthday that June, he threw a party for himself on a huge boat that motored up the Potomac. When police helicopters buzzed the party ship repeatedly, flashing blinding spotlights on the deck, the startled guests assumed that the feds were checking Charlie's party for illicit activity. No, Texas Monthly magazine reported, the police in the copters were not looking for drugs. They just wanted to check out the female duo performing Motown songs. Wilson followed this up the next month with a 4th of July extravaganza in honor of the woman he now claimed was his one true love. The invitation read, "Charlie Wilson invites you to a birthday party for Uncle Sam and his Yankee Doodle sweetheart, Joanne Herring." Everyone had a grand, drunken evening watching the fireworks from his condominium terrace, unquestionably the best seat in the Capitol. All of this merrymaking, however, was a smokescreen concealing a desperate man. Wilson's office was being held together those days only by the extraordinary efforts of the highly competent and protective Angels, and his paternal administrative assistant, Charles Simpson. They made it possible for Wilson to maintain the appearance of normality, but his depressions were deepening, and as the feds closed in on him that summer, Pearson came to believe that the main drug that soothed Wilson's nerves and kept him whole was Afghanistan. It was the only thing that allowed him to function as a man of honor on the Hill, the only thing, perhaps, that made him continue to believe that he had some self-worth. "If he hadn't had Afghanistan, I think he probably would have jumped," Pearson says. To Pearson, Wilson had seemed almost a different man after returning from Pakistan. he had immediately called a press conference to denounce the Russians' use of toy bombs. At that time, the press hadn't been paying particular attention to the Soviets' brutality, but they gave Charlie a lot of play. In spite of his drug troubles, he had managed to seize the high ground, and for a moment at least, he was the public prosecutor indicting the Soviets for their crimes. This aggressive posture carried over into Wilson's dealings with the CIA as well, where, no matter what Chuck Cogan and the others at Langley might have thought about the endangered congressman, they always went to his office when summoned to fill him in on the latest war developments and listen stoically to his demands that they do more.